What do you look for when you travel overseas? Monica Raymond reveals her 10 favorite countries to visit, where she feels welcome and appreciated as a Black woman traveler.
It's really comforting to go somewhere where not only people look like you, but where there's a cultural kind of fluency and fluidity.
Coming up, we'll also look at the price being paid by the sudden cancellation of USAID programs. The head of Bread for the World explains how their advocacy work has had to step into overdrive.
We're urging our lawmakers to do all that they can to ensure that everybody has food and nutrition, not just to survive, but to thrive.
And Poland has seen a lot of history. Besides its great historical and cultural sites, get to know its people, who are proud to do their part to add a little hope in a turbulent world.
We've accepted millions of refugees into our houses. That's the real solidarity movement currently in 21st century.
It's all just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. For more than 1,000 years, it's maintained its identity in between invasions and economic turmoil. And while they still keep one eye on their neighbors to the east, Poland is now thriving as a hub of Central Europe. In a bit, guides from Poland help us plan the ideal week-long getaway to the lively cities and epic history of their homeland. Reverend Eugene Cho heads a faith-based advocacy organization that I've admired for decades. He stops by to tell us how the recent about-face on American support for the needy is impacting their mission advocating for humanitarian aid in the U.S. budget. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves with Onika Raymond. She's a freelance travel writer and TV correspondent, and she's hosted a podcast series called About the Journey. Onika's traveled to more than 100 countries on nearly every continent, and she's back to tell us about her favorite countries to visit as a Black woman who often travels solo. Onika, nice to talk with you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, first of all, can you just kind of give us some context? Because you've got so much going on with your teaching. You've got a podcast, you're hosting TV shows, you're writing, and you've got this passion, this mission to inspire other Black women to get out there and make the world their friend.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I feel that it's very important. I think one of the, not failings, but one of the unfortunate things about the travel industry is that it's very white and it doesn't cater to people who look like me. And oftentimes it can be difficult to find information and resources that specifically pertain to not only Black travelers, but Black female travelers. And so here I am as a Black female traveler, kind of offering my tips and advice.
And you've written, "Normalizing Black Travel Makes It More Accessible."
100%.
And I think that's a beautiful mission. So let's normalize it right now. And let's talk about your 10 favorite places to go. And I read through these and I thought, hey, I'm not a Black person and I'm not a woman. These look like good destinations to me too. So, but we're going to get out there and look at it from the perspective of a Black woman traveler. Brazil is number one on your list. What's so special about Brazil?
Something that I say about Brazil is that not only is it a great time for everybody, I mean, the culture is so vibrant, the sites around the country are incredible, but a lot of people say that Brazil has the body of America and the soul of Africa, and that it's very much a gateway or a getaway that is a kind of a no-brainer for Black women. And the thing is, because the African diaspora is so strong, Black female travelers, I think, are going to feel really comfortable there because not only are they going to see themselves reflected in the population, but also in the culture, the music, and the food. And I think that if you are a Black woman who is new to traveling, yeah, I think it's really comforting to go somewhere where not only people look like you, but where there's a cultural kind of fluency and fluidity, and there's very much an understanding. So it's kind of like a remix of what you've already experienced at home or in your life as a Black female.
And I think without even knowing it, that African diaspora influence is one of the reasons why white and Black travelers enjoy Brazil.
100%.
Next on the list is South Africa.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? Very much the same reasons as Brazil. I mean, first of all, you're going to go for probably, well, not necessarily, but I mean, the safari experience is absolutely incredible. Going to Table Mountain in Cape Town is something that you absolutely have to do as well. But I think that as somebody who is very invested in the Black experience, going to South Africa and learning about apartheid and learning about the history there, I think is important not only for Black female travelers to do, but any Black traveler. That's a very important, you know, maybe a very sad part of history, mm-hmm, but one that's very important to take stock of and to go there and to see it for yourself. So that's absolutely absolutely a destination I'd recommend.
You can't help but be touched by that, the heroism of Nelson Mandela and the heroism of the people to overthrow apartheid, whether you're black or white. And to go there as a black traveler, I can imagine it really is
very powerful.
Next on the list, Onika, we've got France.
I love France. I lived in France for 2 years. I went to university in France. And while people have this stereotypical idea of like Paris and the Parisian cafes and French culture, all of that is absolutely true. But there's a very large Afro-French population. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really worth kind of going and seeing how that side lives. And again, I think for me, as somebody who's of African descent, of somebody who is of Jamaican descent, I always love going and seeing other places in the diaspora to see how my brothers and sisters are living overseas. And so I think I'm just very interested in Black Francophone culture in general, and France is a great place to go and experience that.
Onika Raymond shares tips and opinions to help you explore your own relationship with the world. You'll find her articles and blog posts from visiting six continents at onikathetraveler.com. The next country on your list is Thailand.
I love Thailand. I've been to Thailand 7 times. In fact, last year I spent an entire month in Thailand, and I feel very comfortable there as a Black woman, probably because, you know, Thailand is known as the land of smiles. So the culture is just very welcome and opening. And beyond that, I think particularly if you are someone who is descended from the Caribbean, like myself, you'll really feel at home in Thailand because there are beaches, the food is great. I mean, even though there may not be a direct tie or link to the diaspora, to the African diaspora, I think that the culture is so open and warm that as a Black person, you'll feel comfortable there. And I think as well, very often as Black people, at least in the past, there was a bit more of a reticence or reluctance to travel to Asian countries. And this is one Asian country where you might get some stares, you might get some looks, but trust me, it is all love over there.
Now, that's an interesting issue, to assume positive intent. Somebody's mm-hmm. staring at you, and you could take it as a negative, or you could take it as a positive. And I don't know what the right answer is, but it seems like a lot of times people take something as a negative when actually it's a naive positive.
Right. I think context is really key. And I do believe that in certain places in Asia, they're not accustomed to seeing Black people, or they've only seen them on TV. And so you being there in real life, you end up being kind of an object of curiosity for them.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Onika Raymond. Her podcast is About the Journey. And we're talking about Onika's perspective from a Black woman's point of view on how to make the world her oyster. And we're looking at 10 countries that she finds very welcoming to a Black woman traveler. Let's go to Japan. You've got Japan on your list. What was your experience there?
I love Japan. And actually, I was just there for the second time a few months ago. Japan, I mean, is just such a unique country with a very unique culture. But something that really struck me, both on my first visit and on my visit a few months ago, was how much, I guess, this appreciation for hip hop and reggae and dance hall music and culture is so prevalent in Japan. The first time I went to Japan, I actually went to a dance hall, a reggae dance hall club, and I was greeted by Japanese b-boys who had actually spent time in Jamaica. And so I went with a girlfriend of mine who is also Black, also from the Caribbean. And they were in awe of us. They were practicing their Jamaican patois on us. They knew all of the songs. And I thought, this is wonderful.
Take advantage of that. You're the star of the show. We're going to pick up the tempo now because we still got 4 or 5 countries left. Ethiopia.
Ethiopia is the cradle of civilization. I feel like every Black person, whether they are female or male identified, needs to visit the continent of Africa. It is important for you to do that. I'm going to say that this is a Black traveler, as a Black person, so that you can know yourself.
Yeah. And Jamaica.
My family is from Jamaica. I am very much a Jamaican at heart. And I mean, so many things. I mean, Jamaican culture obviously is renowned the world over. And it's just a beautiful place. So go.
And as you said, sometimes it's nice to go to a place where you are not the odd color on the street.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
United Arab Emirates. That was interesting to find that on your list.
You know, the UAE is just a fascinating place to me in general. I think Dubai and Abu Dhabi are very cosmopolitan. They serve as really good introductions to the Middle East for the first time traveler or for first timers. And you know what? What I've realized in the years since I've written this is that there's actually a large Black expat population in Dubai and in Abu Dhabi. So once again, this is the place to go if you want to kind of go out overseas, hang out with other travelers like yourself. There's a large or a growing Black population over there, and it's kind of put a spin or I guess influenced the inherent culture there, which I think is pretty fun.
And it's less conservative than their Gulf neighbors.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is a great introduction. It's kind of a gateway to the Middle East.
The Maldives. Ah, that picture on your website of you in the Maldives just made me want to go there.
You know, I have had the blessing to visit the Maldives twice. The last time I was there was actually a year ago. And it's very much a destination where you get to treat yourself. And I think that Black women, as Black women, we deserve opportunities to engage in self-care. The Maldives is going to do that. So this is the place where you're going to be surrounded by beauty. You're going to be able to relax and you'll be able to connect and practice self-care. And Maldives absolutely gives you the opportunity to do that.
And our last country on the list of 10 favorite countries to visit as a Black woman is the country where you can climb Mount Kilimanjaro, where you can go on a safari in the Serengeti, and where you can just enjoy the beaches of Zanzibar.
Rick, I mean, you've gone ahead and said it all. I mean, there are so many things to do in Tanzania.
And what country is that? Tanzania.
Well, you know what? I didn't realize you didn't say the country.
I didn't but say that it because I don't know how to pronounce it. I always get it wrong. Tanzania or Tanzania.
You know what? So it's so funny because I feel as though Americans and Canadians, we pronounce it as Tanzania. However, I've heard people from Tanzania pronounce it as Tanzania.
Tanzania. You know? I like that better than anything.
Right.
And as a Black woman,
yeah,
how was that?
I mean, you know, it's an opportunity to reconnect to your roots and go and experience,
you know,
the
I
motherland.
There's a sort of a natural camaraderie or sisterhood when you meet people in Tanzania as you are from Canada, you know, and you're a
100%. I mean, you're basically looking into a mirror. And I love this idea of using travel as a bridge, but going to a place where people look like you and you're going to a place where your ancestors are from, that's a really special thing and a really special feeling, which is why I always encourage all Black travelers to travel to countries in Africa to experience that.
Onika, we've got travelers, Black and white, listening right now. You've put so much energy into sharing this message. What's the fundamental takeaway from your teaching about travel?
I would love people to travel with an open mind and to go see things for themselves and to not let their perspectives be tainted by news reports or by other people who may have an ulterior motive.
Makes so much sense. Let your travel experience shape your worldview rather than some agenda media source. Thanks, Onika, and best wishes with your teaching and happy travels.
Thank you so much.
You'll find links to Onika Raymond with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Advice for a classic week in Poland is just ahead, after we hear about the challenges U.S. relief organizations are now facing. For years, I've been proud of the fact that the United States has long been a leader in fighting hunger and poverty around the world. A combination of government and private funding had been making real gains in the fight against extreme poverty. The United Nations figures about 800 million people are trying to live on about $2 a day. That's what they call extreme poverty. It's usually with no running water, health care, or electricity, and little or no education or hope. Relief efforts had been able to cut those numbers in half in recent years. Anti-hunger organizations saw an end to hunger as a real possibility in our lifetimes. But setbacks caused by climate change and wars complicated things before the pandemic made it even worse. Now, the sudden cutoff of U.S. support by the Trump administration is taking a big toll on progress against world hunger. Because most Americans vastly overestimate the expense and vastly underestimate the effectiveness of these efforts, I've long supported the advocacy efforts of Bread for the World. So I've asked their president, the Reverend Eugene Cho, to tell us about the current state of the fight against global hunger. Eugene, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
You run an organization called Bread for the World. Can you tell me what is that and what's your mission?
Sure. Bread for the World is a faith organization. It's an advocacy organization, and we are advocating for the end of hunger, both here in the United States and around the world. We're urging our lawmakers to do all that they can to ensure that everybody has food and nutrition, not just to survive, but to thrive.
You know, I've supported Bread for the World for decades, and to me, it's not really a charity. It's a service. You speak out for citizens that care about this issue.
That's right. And for folks that are making investments, we're able to just urge our lawmakers to make smart investments around policies and legislation that won't just impact one person or one family, but has the ability to impact millions upon millions of people.
You know, we're several months into a new president's administration. Tell me how things are going from your point of view.
Well, I don't want to mince words here. It's been, for this work, incredibly discouraging and demoralizing. There have been tremendous cuts to life-saving aid and humanitarian assistance, 83% of cuts to grants. And that is incredibly, incredibly painful.
So the government has assessed the $40 billion or so that they've invested in an organization or department of the government called USAID and decided it's not a good investment of taxpayer money. So they've taken apart and disbanded that department. They've kept what they think the 20% of that budget that is still worth the taxpayer's dollar, and they're putting that into another department, and a very one-fifth of the power of this organization supposedly will live on.
Mm.
You know, as a traveler, I'm so thankful that I've seen and witnessed these kind of realities abroad. I love the quote by Mohammed. Mm. He said, "Don't tell me how educated you are. Tell me how much you've traveled." Mm. Well, you've traveled, and you've seen the work of our government's aid programs in action.
Mm.
Give us one example, if you could, of an inspirational moment you saw in a very poor country that made you proud to be an American.
Sure. Well, let me just say this. I think one of the things that gives me hope is not just about what we as Americans do. I really want to highlight and lift up local voices, local leaders, and sort of their ingenuity, their creativity, their resilience. And a story that I can give is traveling to South Africa and to see how investments, education is able to lift smallholder farmers. And these women who may not have had initial business acumen or businesses, but they have thriving businesses, thriving farms that are just bringing in so much life and vitality into their villages.
You know, Eugene, in your work, you've got to raise awareness of the practicality and the rationale for this kind of use of taxpayer money. And there are lots of misunderstandings, I guess you could say. In fact, for a lot of people, taxpayer-funded aid is actually controversial. What are some of the myths? Give us a couple myths about foreign aid.
There are myths and there's also lies. And I think we have to name both. And that's incredibly discouraging when you are using lies to debunk something. So three things really quickly. Number one is that there are some people who believe that humanitarian assistance is a tremendously large part of the U.S. budget. We're talking less than 1%. Number two, that U.S. is the only one doing the lifting, when in fact, other nations and private enterprises and civil society organizations and faith groups, it's an all hands on deck. Now, the U.S., obviously, because it has a large budget, does give more. But in terms of percentage, there are other nations who give more. And the last one that really, really upsets me and riles me up is this accusation that whether it's USAID or people that are doing this work out of conviction, they're lunatics or radicals or they're criminals. And that's just blatantly false.
Mm. It is heartbreaking because I know people who have been on a track to make a lot of money with a fancy university degree and a lot of energy that have decided they're going to dedicate their lives to helping other people earning a school teacher's wage in the trenches.
Well, and
in a dangerous world out there. And they're the ones that have been had their character assassinated.
Well, and this is the reason why it's so painful. No one is saying that humanitarian assistance is perfect. No one is saying that. And no one is saying that we're against more transparency or more efficiency. We all want that. But then to take maybe a couple bad examples or a couple examples and to give the illusion that that's the totality, that's nonsense.
Our guest on Travel with Rick Steves is Reverend Eugene Cho. He's the president and CEO of Bread for the World. It's a citizens' movement that speaks up in the halls of government on behalf of hungry and impoverished people. Organizations like his are scrambling right now to minimize the impact of massive cuts in U.S. aid, both overseas and at home. We have more about their work at ricksteves.com/radio. You know, the first myth about foreign aid that you brought up was that people think it's a big part of our budget. We need to think about it in terms of relative thinking here. There's 300 plus million Americans, and we spend $800 billion a year on our military, which is, you can make a good case for that. We spend 5% of that supporting USAID, $40 billion. The question is that the right amount relative to the amount of money we have to invest on making us safer? That's hard power or soft power, and how do you finesse that?
Mm.
And that's an open question. But we got to remember that right now, $40 billion invested, and a lot of times it's invested with strings attached. I know that a big talking point these days is it has to make America great and power and strong.
Mm.
It's always had strings attached.
Mm-hmm.
A lion's share of that $40 billion goes to Israel and Egypt because these are important allies of ours.
Mm. Yeah, there's obviously relationship building with allies. There's also relationship building with people that we're also trying to engage with. But let me give you a couple more examples. I mean, we spend $2 billion investing in American farmers and American commodities. That comes out of that USAID budget, and that infuses American economy as well.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Reverend Eugene Cho. Eugene's the president of Bread for the World. It's a citizens' movement that speaks up for hungry people in the halls of our government. Today, organizations like Bread are scrambling to minimize the impact of massive cuts in U.S. aid to extremely poor and hungry people, both overseas and here in the United States. And we're learning more about their frustrations, goals, and reasons for hope. Bread's website is simply bread.org. Eugene, I'm fascinated by when you have this money, how does it actually get into the world of people who it's directed to? And I understand you could have $40 billion supporting America's approach to the world's effort to fight hunger. A lot of that money goes to the United Nations World Food Program, and then that goes to empower existing organizations that are well set up and in the trenches doing that work.
Mm.
It's not like a middleman where everybody takes 10% and there's a lot of leakage that way.
Mm.
But I understand, because I'm friends with the former director of the World Food Program, Director Beasley, that they relied heavily on USAID, and then they invested that money in NGOs in the field. This is not governments funding other governments, but governments the United States in concert with other countries that care.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how that money works. Do I understand it correctly?
Yeah, I think so, broadly speaking. But I would maybe even begin by saying that this is appropriated by Congress, right? This is so important. Congress has made these decisions based on priorities. And of course, they're funding USAID, who will use incredibly tremendous vetting to make sure that they're finding the right partners like WFP. Now, everyone's going to tell you that, of course, we can make it more efficient. There is some bureaucracy for sure. But I love the fact that their job is to ensure as much resources go to where it's needed the most, including finding local organizations and local leaders.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Reverend Eugene Cho. Eugene's the president of Bread for the World, and that's a citizens' movement that speaks up for hungry people in the halls of our government. Bread's website is bread.org. Eugene, we could talk forever. I'm so thankful for your expertise and your passion. I'm going to do this little word association game here, and we just got a couple minutes left, but I'm going to say a word. And you're running an organization that's trying to have our government take seriously the struggle of hungry people south of the border. I'd like to hear your quick response to that word. Sudan.
There's a famine going on right now. We can't forget them.
Haiti.
the closest nation to the United States and yet the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
I understand their number one export is topsoil when a deforested land gets the violent rainstorms that come with climate change. It's just a heartbreaking situation in Haiti. Ukraine.
Oh, my goodness. We need peace in that place, but we also need to respect their sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. Ukraine is the breadbasket of the former Soviet Union, isn't it?
And that's the reason why it contributed tremendously to hunger around the world, that they produced 40% of the global wheat supplies.
And when they can't export that, the cost of grain goes up in Africa to people whose 80% of their family budget is food.
There were some countries where 100% of their wheat supplies came from Ukraine.
Ebola.
I'm very scared because we're seeing stories and reports of Ebola outbreaks around the world, and USAID cuts impacted some of those programs.
How does USAID impact the safeguards against Ebola pandemic?
Monitoring, screening, to make sure that there's medical experts to do all of these things. Now, U.S. isn't the only country, but they were a significant part of that ecosystem.
Man, as a taxpayer, spend some of my money there, you know?
And I want you to know, just to make it real, just recently, there was a 12-year-old girl in Ethiopia who passed away because of Ebola.
Water.
Water is life, and it's so important.
Cost $4,000 to drill a well for a thirsty community, and then all the mothers can stay home instead of walking across the county every morning to get their water. Stunting.
Every child deserves not just to survive, but to thrive. And to think about 45 million children right now suffering from the worst form of malnutrition called stunting and wasting, we can do something about this.
What's the 1,000 days thing about stunting?
So data, science, evidence has shown that the first 1,000 days of a child's life from conception to their second birthday is the most important period of investment.
Wow. Nutrient-rich paste. Super peanut butter.
For just the small investment, when we're able to produce and offer these nutrient-rich paste or ready-to-use therapeutic foods, that can help a child's life or someone who is in extreme hunger have a reverse of their health to be able to survive.
One of the most joyful moments I've seen was when I was at a health post off the grid in Ethiopia once a week. The World Food Program, the United Nations, would come in and open up the health post. Women would gather there. They'd learn about nutrition, and they'd leave with bundles of that super peanut butter, and boy, they were happy. China.
Ooh, this is a tough one because they are on the wings trying to get involved, exercising their soft power.
I remember when it was winning the hearts and souls of developing nations was between the USSR and the USA. Today, it's really between the United States and China, and China's going at it quite smartly.
Well, most folks don't know that Africa holds the majority of its debt to China.
And when you go there, you see it. You see work crews making roads everywhere, and the foreman is Chinese.
And this isn't meant to be anti-China or anti-Chinese. I think Americans need to understand that diplomacy happens in so many different ways.
Advocacy.
For me, this is the most important thing. We need our voices to be heard. There are so many industries, so many companies that are spending so much money trying to get their interests heard. And I want your listeners to know that for our neighbors who are struggling with hunger and poverty, it's not that they don't have a voice. Their voices are not heard. And that's why advocacy matters.
Wow. We're looking at what the sudden defunding of American humanitarian relief agencies means through the eyes of our guest, Eugene Cho. He's the CEO of Bread for the World. It's a nonpartisan, faith-based advocacy nonprofit whose mission I have long admired and personally supported. There's more about their work at bread.org. Eugene, it's easy to think of the impact of the defunding of USAID in terms of statistics, but it's also a challenge to think of the humanity of it all. In your travels, what's a moment where you've been inspired by the importance of this work and the heroics of people who dedicate their lives to fighting hunger in the trenches in countries that are so struggling. Mm.
Man, I wish I could take all of your listeners in for some of the meetings I've had. There are heroes all around the world, resilient leaders who are doing so much to lift themselves, their families, their villages out of poverty. I would love to share glimpses of those kinds of stories. But also, I think I'm reminded that we're all connected together as fellow human beings. Some of the people that I've met who've struggled with hunger, they have been the most incredibly generous people who invite me into their huts, into their homes, and we drink tea together and we drink coffee together, and they're able to share a little bit about their stories, their backgrounds, and listen to this, they also share their hopes and dreams. And I think what makes us human is this idea that we're connected to one another and that we want the best for ourselves and we want the best for our children and we want our children to be able to have an opportunity to dream for themselves as well.
Wow. Eugene, how do you stay hopeful when our government has basically said developing aid is no longer a priority? There's no more money there.
Three things. One, I look back at the tremendous impact that the world has made against extreme poverty. No one can take that away. Number two, no matter where I travel or who I speak to, I come across so many people who care about these very issues. And the last thing that I'll say, while it's a discouraging time, I want folks to hear this really well. It's not the end. This is not the end, and we have much more work to do.
Eugene, thank you so much for your work. Thanks for joining us, and best wishes.
Thank you so much.
You'll find web links to Eugene Cho and Bread for the World in the notes for this week's show. That's at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next, guides from Poland recommend a week-long itinerary for seeing what's new and what's timeless in their beautiful country. It's Travel with Rick Steves.
Benvinguts, I'm Dick, Jesus Ruiz, viaggio con Rick Steves. That was Catalan, and in English it would be, my name is Jesus Ruiz, welcome, and I travel with Rick Steves. Once again, I'm Dick, Jesus Ruiz, viaggio con Rick Steves, benvinguts.
Touch one of the bricks on the church you're standing in front of in Gdansk, and you're making contact with 700 years of Polish history. Add in visits to artsy Krakow and the surprisingly swanky capital, Warsaw. Sprinkle in some smaller town countryside stops as well, and you'll get to experience how much Poland has come alive in the past generation. The dreary days of the communist 20th century are well behind them now. For an update on what it's like to visit Poland today and what you should plan on seeing, we're delighted to be joined now by Polish tour guides Tomasz Klimek and Agnes Siroka.
How wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I'm just actually thrilled to have two of my favorite Polish guides right here at this table, and we get to share your expertise about your beautiful country. So basically, how do Americans need to update their expectations of Poland, including me, Agnes?
You know, because some of our tour members still have the vision of wild bears walking down the streets, grey communist comic condos along the street, and then when I come and see beautifully developed country and beautiful landscapes, history and tremendous food, they say it's the biggest unpolished diamond.
Yeah, I mean, I went, of course, I've got a Cold War heritage, and I really was excited to go to Warsaw during communist times because it was an adventure. But I went back, I've seen this transition in the last generation. And I remember I took a photograph, it was in Krakow, of a fountain, and the kids were jumping in the fountain. It was a modern fountain, modern kids, modern life. And I thought, it's important for me to update my image of places we used to think were Eastern Europe. Tomasz, we've just changed the name in our lexicon here from Eastern to Central. What is your thoughts about, because most Americans say, oh, you're from Poland, you're in Eastern Europe.
And we want to thank you for that, because Central Europe kind of brings us more close to the truth, actually, not only geographically, but also psychologically, because when you think Eastern Europe, it puts you back to this like Soviet bloc, okay?
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Because Eastern really was created by the Iron Curtain and the Wall. So
yes.
He was West and free and East and communist.
So it's good for us to be back in Central Europe, because this is where we were for centuries.
There is an Eastern Europe. What would that be?
Eastern Europe would be everything east of Poland. So our border, it's not only the border with Belarus, with Ukraine, with Russia, but it's also the NATO.
You have some border. Interesting neighbors.
Oh, yes. It's also NATO border, which makes us say...
You're on the right side of the NATO border.
It's a European Union border as
European
well.
European Union border.
So it's a very important border. And this border would also mark the east. So.
Okay.
Czech mathematics. What? We are very close to the mathematical central part of the European continent.
Oh, okay, because the European continent goes all the way to the Ural Mountains.
Yeah.
So that, like, the western third of Russia is geographically Europe, right?
Exactly.
Agnes, I love how you both earn your living as tour guides in Poland. And you like to say that you make your living traveling in your country and teaching it as if the bus is a rolling classroom.
Exactly.
What is that? How does that bring you joy to have people on the bus and you're the teacher?
I'm the teacher. That's a rolling classroom. I love my tour members to touch a medieval brick wall, and I take them back to medieval building side of the cathedral, of the biggest brick church and the biggest brick castle in the world that they see. And when they touch, when they hear the story of clay and why the Vistula River was the main transportation route in medieval age times, it broadens their perspective. They open their eyes and they feel the story.
And that's gratifying as a teacher, isn't it?
Oh, I love it. I love it.
We just were there with your help and with Tomasz's help making a TV show on Poland. And we've got a 1-hour special that'll be airing all over the country on public television. And we wrote this script, and it starts in Krakow, it goes to Warsaw, and then it goes to Gdansk.
Exactly.
And I always have to think Gdansk or Danzig. That means I'm kind of old, because Danzig was the German name for Gdansk. Right?
Exactly. That was Freistadt Danzig. But still, when you fly on many European airports, instead of Gdansk, which is so difficult to pronounce, you still have Danzig. And it's still Danzig. Somewhere in mentality as well.
Oh, okay. So I'm okay once in a while to trip on that.
Well, yeah, we're okay with that.
But what I was doing was, when I finally wrote that script for a 1-hour show, it occurred to me it's all along the Vistula River. Tomasz, it seems like the Vistula must be very central to the Polish people. Or what does the Vistula River mean to Poland?
So Vistula River, we actually call it the queen of our rivers, as river in Polish is feminine. So it's the river that is all within Polish borders.
Uh-huh.
All of the most important cities are located by the river, which was, of course, as Agnes just said, the very important transportation route. Both in summertime, but also if you think of those heavy winters, yes, this was the only part that was like frozen and on slates. Somehow you can still continue on traveling. So all year round, it would provide you with some decent transport possibilities.
And it was, in some ways, I would imagine, kind of like the nipple of Poland to the rest of the world, because you have
a connection, definitely.
Gdansk, and that was a Hanseatic town. And all of the nutrition to help the vitality of Poland, much of it must have come by boat in the old days to Gdansk.
Yes, we were like a basket of Europe, as very often Poland was referred to, because
the granary of Europe.
The granary of Europe. Our guides to Poland are Agnes Siroka from the lively port city of Gdansk and Tomasz Klimek, who lives in Krakow, the country's cultural and historic capital. You can also look for them joining me on my latest public TV special about Poland. Gdansk was part of the Hanseatic League.
Exactly.
And in the Middle Ages, before you had centralized governments and big free trade zones that are countries, you had merchant cities.
Yeah, I always like to refer it to Gdansk, because, you know, that was the European Union before it was officially organized.
There you go, spreading from basically from London all the way to St. Petersburg.
Exactly. That's why when people come and see the architecture, they have a feeling, I've been there before.
Amsterdam, Lübeck, Berlin.
Name it.
I love it. And this is the joy of traveling with a little higher expectations. For a lot of people, Hanseatic League, their eyes glaze over, you know. But a good tour guide can make the Hanseatic League fun to know about. Tell about the big crane in Gdansk.
You know, because of being the port of the Kingdom of Poland, the city was very rich.
Yeah.
So what was the way to show you're really well off? Build the buildings no other city can afford to have. That's why we ended up with the biggest brick constructions in the world, including the crane, like huge hamster wheels.
Big, yeah, you would have literally
people inside
human
walking.
Hamsters walking on this treadmill, going around and around to load and offload goods from the boats.
Exactly. And imagine no electricity, 14th century, and 3 tons of goods powered by men.
That is
still standing.
Massive. Still standing. That's massive technology from 600-700 years ago. My goodness, there's so much history in this country. You've got the rich history from the Middle Ages, and you've got these great medieval buildings and massive castles. You've also got a very complicated and difficult 20th century in Poland. And you have a difficult history, period. I mean, the Polish people, how many millions of people are in Poland now, roughly?
It's 38 million Poland and around 20 million outside of Poland.
So lots of diaspora.
And the size of New Mexico.
Okay, there you go. And you can look at this size of New Mexico, 30 million people, and you think you're between Germany and Russia. And when Germany wants to push east or if Russia wants to push west,
we are in the middle.
The Polish people pack up and walk hundreds of miles that way or that way, and they are like, their whole life is refugee city.
Our
location, that was for a century. There was no Poland on the map.
That was, yeah. This is not the very fortunate location between the two giants. So, yes.
But thank goodness you've got firm borders now.
Firm borders. This is like the most peaceful period in the history of Poland ever right now.
That's
amazing. If you look at it.
And you're close to the Ukraine war. It must be a little bit nerve-wracking.
That's why we did so much help, and that's why thank you for supporting all the projects.
Well, let's just say any American who was able to travel in Europe and go to Poland and then to understand how Poland prizes and treasures its history, its freedom. I mean, it's freedom and how the history has been such a struggle. And it's a whim politically on our part, whether we are part of NATO or not, and whether we support freedom or not in Europe. And for me, it's a human question. It's a what is just. And there is such a fragile and beautiful and appreciated freedom all over our Western world. And this is an issue of today, and I just love the fact that our travelers can go to Poland. People can be inspired by our books or our TV shows or whatever, and go to Poland and find guides like you to help them appreciate that.
When you have that history, you know, it's coming to Gdańsk and hearing about Lech Wałęsa and Solidarity, 1980, but now you come when we have war behind the border and we've accepted millions of refugees into our houses. That's the real solidarity movement currently in 21st century.
There you go, the solidarity. It was in Poland where Lech Wałęsa and the Union of Shipworkers stood up bravely, courageously, and cracked the invincibility of the Soviet Union. And from that came freedom for 100 million people in Central Europe.
Exactly.
And today, with all the refugees from Ukraine, from that tragedy there, coming from Russia, they end up heading west, and in solidarity, the people of Poland house them. I went to great churches all along the countries that are neighboring the conflicts further east. And the churches are filled with donated goods that are going to refugees, and people are housing refugees. And it's a solidarity thing, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's inspirational.
The solidarity flows in our veins, sort of, in a different form nowadays, but it still does.
Solidarity flows in your veins, and I want to be part of that.
You are.
Well, everybody can be part of that when
everybody can be part of
and
that.
And support local economy. You support the fight with Ukraine.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We are talking about Poland now with our two Polish guides, Agnes Siroka and Tomasz Klimek. So I was marveling at how complicated and many-faceted the history of Poland is. Of course, Krakow was the historic capital, I think, of the Polish people.
That's correct.
Warsaw is the modern capital. Mm-hmm. And Gdansk is a place where so much history has happened.
It's the capital of freedom.
Three huge things have happened almost within sight of each other over history. What are the big historical landmarks from Gdansk?
So if you think of the more recent history, the first shots of the Second World War took place exactly in Gdansk, in the small peninsula of Westerplatte, where early morning on the 1st of September 1939, first shots started the Second World War. And another landmark moment was 1989, when the Solidarity Movement smashed the communism and this first domino fell. Always when we think of fall of the communism, people will think of fall of the Berlin Wall. But actually, Berlin Wall fell a few months after, and first domino was Poland. Then the other countries would follow.
And you've got history going much, much earlier than that. Great astronomers, Polish.
Nicholas Copernicus, born
Copernicus.
In Torun.
Torun.
Our gingerbread capital.
I was just having some gingerbread last night, and it took me back to Torun.
Exactly, Nicholas Copernicus.
So let's talk about, you know, we've talked about Krakow and Warsaw and Gdansk. Let's talk about some of the smaller places we can see, not always on the Vistula River, but most likely on the Vistula.
Of course, Torun.
T-O-R-U-N.
Torun used to be the seaport as much as Gdansk in medieval age times, also Hanseatic city.
Yeah.
On the UNESCO heritage list, like Krakow.
Yeah,
you know,
and when you go there, you've got you can sit on a statue of Copernicus and have some gingerbread.
Have gingerbread, have great ice cream, and people watching. You know, Nicholas Copernicus is a very good Polish product.
Yeah, for sure. And just a half-hour drive from there or something is the biggest pile of bricks I've ever seen.
Oh, that's my place on earth, you know.
Tell me
that's
about
my
it.
Passion. I collect medieval handmade bricks, and I promote medieval bricks all over the world.
Whoa, I've never met a brick enthusiast like this. Yeah. Well, you know, we have to remember the architecture we look at in our travels is determined by what is available in the natural resources in that region. So if there's good marble nearby, you might have marble. If there's granite, you'll have granite. If there's wood, you'll have wood. And if there's not much else,
you have clay, so you clay, build, make bricks. You make bricks.
But tell us about that castle.
Marlborough Castle is the biggest brick castle in the world. And it's amazing because it took 30 million bricks to build it. And that was the capital of the Teutonic headquarters. Like, you know, we've heard
Teutonic,
about...
The Teutonic Knights.
Like Templars, that Crusaders.
That was their brick house.
That was their brick house. And it's an amazing. It's on the UNESCO heritage list. And
you stand there and you can see the moat. It wouldn't have alligators and water in it, but there's a land area that is wide open so people who are attacking can be seen from a distance.
Exactly. It's flat like a table and you can see everybody coming.
And then this wall of bricks. It's just magnificent. And who were the Teutonic Knights, Tomasz?
So Teutonic Knights were some of the Templars. So when you think of the Holy Land, this is where they were protecting the pilgrims, protecting Holy Land. At a certain point, they had to go. They returned to Europe, being bored, sort of looking for some ideas.
Oh, so this is a kind of a military protect the pilgrims order. And when they didn't have much to do, they found, hey, we could kind of settle in here. And they had all of this power.
And we can offer our services, whoever needs. So we actually invited them because we had some slight problems, but they liked it so much that they stayed for nearly 300 years.
So we can see that castle in Malbork, M-A-L-B-O-R-G.
Exactly.
Now, we've talked about the three great cities. We've talked about Torun and Malbork. I'd like to talk about beaches on the Baltics, and I'd like to talk about the Carpathian Mountains. Let's talk about the mountains first, because when I went to Poland in communist times, that's when people couldn't travel very far, and it was communist, so everybody had the same camera, everybody had the same vacation, and everybody would go to the same place, and they would just say, okay, in July you go, in August you go, in September you go. That's my sense. Everybody went to Zakopane.
Zakopane is still beautiful. Zakopane is like a capital of the mountains, but it's more than Zakopane in the mountains. Yeah. There's a very rich culture. There's not to mention the landscape, the food, and the culture that remained there practically intact. People wearing their traditional dresses, not maybe on every day, but let's say every Sunday for all the family occasions. And this is not real. This is not folklore for tourism. This is alive.
This is natural.
Culture, natural culture. This is honest. So if you want to experience something like this, mountains is a must.
There's a northern area of Romania that's just along the border. What is that?
It is the same mountains, actually. Because the Carpathian Range passes through Slovakia, Ukraine, goes all the way to Romania.
And life there is like an open-air folk museum also.
Exactly.
So the Zakopane is where you find some very strong traditions.
Still real.
And that would be a side trip from Krakow or what?
This is like 80 miles south of Krakow.
There you go.
A one-hour drive.
And what if I want to just sit on a cold and rainy beach and shiver?
Oh, come on. We still have a few sunny days.
Tell me about your beach. A beach resort on the Baltic. Tell me about
that. Yes, Baltic is cold, but we have beautiful sunny beaches. And after the storm, you can just walk down the beach and collect amber, the petrified resin, which is over 50 million years old. And if you are lucky, you can find an inclusion there. Like the biggest lizard that was found and is in the museum right now.
Like Jurassic Park.
Like a
fossil of a lizard or something. Amber is a big deal.
Yes, Gdansk is described as the world amber capital. Mm-hmm. You find it in the south of Baltic.
So. As a matter of fact, there's a wonderful little museum and a beautiful shops featuring amber in Gdansk.
Amber is every corner. We have amber Ferris wheel, amber football stadium, name it, you have it. Amber altar, everything is there.
Wow. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been dreaming about Poland, and there's so many dimensions to it, and it's just such a pleasure to have both of you here sharing your love and your knowledge of your home country. Agnes Sirocka and Tomasz Klimek, how do I say thank you?
Dziękuję.
Dziękuję. Dziękuję, and I hope to see you again in Poland.
Dziękujemy. Thank you for having us.
Dziękujemy.
You bet.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. When you're on a road trip, you can listen to Travel with Rick Steves on one of more than 500 other radio stations. You'll find a list of where and when at ricksteves.com/radio. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
The Rick Steves guidebooks are consistently the best-selling series of guides to Europe. That's because we lovingly update them in person and cut through all the superlatives to give you hard and smart opinions based on decades of experience. Find them at your favorite bookseller and at ricksteves.com.